Well, let's talk about you and your work. And I had just received the 50th anniversary edition of The Power and the Glory, which I'm going to be reading this week in preparation for a recapitulation of an interview I did with Norman Sherry about Graham Greene, who is such a wonderful writer. And this is, I know, his masterpiece, and it's a book somehow I just haven't read. Now I have the chance. But you were telling me a moment ago, let's get you up a little closer here. Tell me a moment ago that Greene was a great influence on you.
Graham Greene was a great influence on me. I don't know quite how I got started reading him, as most writers do. I got started reading when I was very young and never stopped. When I'm not writing, I'm reading. And I love Graham Greene because whatever else he does, and he does a great many other things, humor among them, but whatever else he does, he always tells you a story. There's a strong narrative line always in his work. You mentioned a while back about the power and the glory of the church and the state, and Mexico has been outlawed, and all the cathedrals turned into banks, and the priests had two options, marry or die. But there was one priest who went underground, And he, being a priest, was God's man in the world and could intercede between man and God and hear confession and the rest of it. But he was also a whiskey priest. He would get the wine he was supposed to use, and he would drink and get drunk. He had a child out of wedlock. He was a flawed human being. And Graham Greene, as you know, is converted to Roman Catholicism at, when he was a grown man. He married a Catholic and converted to Catholicism. And apparently it's not apocryphal. He had an audience with Pope, and that book was on the list that Pope Catholics weren't supposed to read at that time. Graham Greene asked him, he said, either the Pope said, you know, my favorite book of yours is Power and Glory. And Graham Greene said, well, you know, Your Eminence, what do you say to a Pope? That's on the index, you know. And the Pope is supposed to have said back to him, and again, I don't believe this is apocryphal. I think it actually happened. The Pope simply said, well, you can't please everyone all the time.
Greene, I understand that Greene actually went to Mexico.
Oh yeah,
His travels in a harrowing, arduous odyssey through Mexico.
He did indeed, and a book like Our Man in Havana came out of the same thing. He went down to Cuba and spent a lot of time down there, or some time down there, and I don't know how much traveling he's done in recent years.
Well, he's well in his 80s.
Because he's a very old man, has, of course, been nominated any number of times for the Nobel Prize. I've always thought that if he lived long enough, he'd win it.
Do you have to be alive to win the Nobel Prize?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Seems to me that someone like Greene could be awarded the prize posthumously.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's been he's not only a novelist, but he's written travel books, and he's written any number of plays. Yeah. The Potting Shed is the play most people know, if they know anything about his plays. And they've done very well. And they've done very well in around the world, but specifically in England. And prolific, yes, he is. While I've read, I think, everything he's written, I can't give you the exact number of books that he's got, but certainly over 30, and I think closer to 35 than 30.
You've taught for many years. I would assume that Greene was one of the authors that you taught.
I have. Well, I've taught The Power and the Glory and The End of the Affair, which is a wonderful, wonderful book. Where you read halfway through the book, absolutely caught up in this rather messy affair and twisted circumstances in people's lives, believing one thing because the evidence is there for you to believe it, and you're absolutely into it, and it's absolutely credible. And then the woman involved dies. The man who has been having an affair with her finds her diary, and then he reads it. But the diary simply appears in the book. There it is. You read it, too. You're reading as he's reading. And everything that you had believed up to that point is 180 degrees in the other direction. And it's a wonderful book, wonderfully crafted, and one of the great reads.
You said something very interesting at the outset of our chat, that he was a great storyteller and influential to you because of that. Isn't that the purpose of a writer? I have heard some people say, well, I have a point to make. I have a theme that I wish to express, a message to impart. But when you come right down to it, telling the story seems to me to be the way to get the reader involved in what you want to say.
Let me quickly respond to that by saying just this. If you want to send a message, go to Western Union. You want to preach, get a pulpit. You want social reform, stand for public office. All of the best fiction and the fiction that I'm interested in writing is all about the same thing. I think all of the great literature is about the same thing. Hemingway or Faulkner or F. Scott Fitzgerald about the same thing. It's people doing the best they can with what they've got to do with. And the reader's job is to involve the reader's job, the writer's job. The writer's job is to involve the reader in the book in such a fashion that he is forced to make moral judgments about what is going on in the fiction. And it is a psychological truism that you cannot make a judgment about me until you first make a judgment about yourself. Because, you see, if you can't get past the clothes I'm wearing, if you look at my clothes and say that they're peculiar, they're kinky, they're funny, they're twisted, they're whatever, well, that only means that you have made the judgment that you would never be caught dead in such circumstances. Now, that's true of moral circumstances, too. A good book will inevitably turn the reader back upon himself. Faulkner, in his Nobel Prize speech, the only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself. When you do something wrong, you're off base, being bad. Nobody has to tell you as a rule. You pretty much know very well that you're wrong. Hemingway's definition of moral is what you feel good after. Immoral is what you feel bad after. And most of the times when I have felt badly, if that's ungrammatical, when I felt bad, afterwards I did something wrong and knew it. But yes, it's to get this, suck the writer out of his own skin for a while and put him in somebody else's skin and life and circumstances and situations. Because after all, when somebody picks up your book, or let's leave it at that book, he's thinking of everything in the world except what you want him to think about. He's thinking about the mortgage on the house, Susie's broken arm, his wife's anger at him for the last week, which he's trying to undo. And you have to gently take his sensibilities and his mind, his emotions, his psychological state, and refocus them on a world that takes him out of the mortgage and away from the angry wife and the damaged child and into your world, and consequently turning back upon himself. Otherwise, you're not writing fiction. You're writing something else. Now, there are other books that it's called fiction. I could name some writers. Ayn Rand, who wrote Atlas Shrugged, We the Living, and so on and so forth. Fountainhead. She had a philosophy in which she felt the greatest good came out of total selfishness, and it has been taught in some universities. And every novel she wrote came in bearing that burden. Most people don't know that Jean-Paul Sartre is also, besides being a philosopher and great many other things, a novelist. Every one of his novels comes in bearing the burden of atheist existentialism. It's my feeling that sort of thing is better done in essays rather than in novels or plays or, for that matter, even poetry.
Yeah, not too long ago, I picked up a copy of Atlas Shrugged, a book that I had read when I was in college and was very impressed by it.
When I was in college, I thought she just...
Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And, it was a way to justify atheism and to try to get out of a conservative mold of those of us from the Midwest. Recently, I picked up my copy, old paperback of Atlas Shrugged, and it is not readable. I could not read it. She had no subtlety. She would hit you over the head with her characters. There was no delicacy to the prose, and I don't know how I could have been sucked in by it at the age
of
20.
Same way I was. Well, I was out of the Marine Corps by then. I was 21 years old. I have an essay about that somewhere. Where I said, I was 21 when I started to go to the university on the GI Bill, and I thought she was the greatest writer going, and quite on my own, in about 2 years, I realized that she couldn't write a lick, and of course I had long before that determined that if I was going to be anything in this world as a writer, I came to that very early, and I'm glad I did.
Now, you said a moment ago that one of the tasks of the writer is to suck the reader in and to make him escape the mortgage payments and all of the humdrum things that he has to do every day. It's hard to do, but it can be done. In Body, for example, very seldom do I laugh out loud, but there's the one scene where I believe his name is Bat.
Yeah, Billy Bat.
Billy Bat, by the swimming pool.
Got the greatest back in the world.
Yeah, the greatest... And the family runs to him and gives him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And it's such a hilarious scene, and I'm laughing out loud. You sucked me into the book.
Yeah, well, thank you.
You brought me into it. It's very hard to do, though, because so many books... I read from 2 to 4 books a week.
Yeah.
Some of them are just dull, or somehow I don't identify with the characters in some way. Sometimes I do. Sometimes they make me... I was reading Jeffrey Wolfe's book, The Final Club, and I felt for the character in this book. I almost cried. So, of course, I'm emotional anyway, so books can do that to me. The words can do that to me. Let's talk about Body a little bit. This is almost a companion. You had a book, called Knockout.
The Knockout Artist, yeah, about boxing. Yeah. I spent a good part of my life in gymnasiums, first in fight gymnasiums, then in karate dojos. I've got a book called Karate's a Thing in the
Excuse
Spirit.
Me, Harry?
Sorry.
You're early. Jeff?
Yes, I am.
Would you like to come in and sit with us?
Sure.
Jeffrey Wolfe is Harry Cruz.
Oh, my goodness.
How are you, sir? Yeah. Forgive me for not getting
that. Oh, please don't. Please
good to see you.
I'm a great
fan
of yours, as you probably know.
Why don't you sit down with us, and we're talking about Harry's new book, Body.
Well, shut up. I mean,
and then we'll talk, and when we're finished with Harry, we'll go with you.
Now I'm intimidated with this man in the room.
Well,
all right. I'm an admirer of his, and so
I was just talking.
Just talk about your book.
I was talking about this book. I was telling Harry how a scene in Body just broke me up and made me laugh. How several scenes in The Final Club almost made me weep. How does a writer do this? How does a writer be able to suck, as you said, the reader into these pages?
It's a great question to which I have not a very adequate answer, perhaps no answer at all. I'll just go ahead and say it. My books are funny. Enough people have told me so that and sometimes I know they're funny parts of when I'm writing them. My friends will also tell you that I'm not funny in person. It's not that I don't have a sense of humor. I just, I'm not the kind of guy that goes around making people laugh. But if you talk about, getting somebody out of their skin into somebody else's skin, or into the circumstances, motivations, and wherewithal of somebody else's life, it's done in a great many different ways, but this is almost a cliche, but I'll go ahead and say it. Writing is good to the degree that is concrete and specific, and bad to the degree that is abstract and vague. And so when you're building the world that the characters that you are writing about walk through, If the reader cannot, and we'll get past smelling it and hearing it and seeing it and almost tasting it. If he can't almost feel it on the surface of his skin, if you can't do that with the physical world, there are some exceptions among writers, but generally speaking, if you can't do that with the physical world, you'll never be able to do that with people. And the name of this game, at least as far as I'm concerned, is credibility. To make the reader really believe not only what is happening, but that what is happening is the only thing that could happen. That's the way all kind. Ian Forster said writers shouldn't have to write endings because endings nothing ever ends, and a good many writers do come to grief over endings. But
that's why a writer never puts the end at the end of a story.
Credibility is the name of the game. If the reader has got to believe it, and we're talking about endings. You've got two things I want to say, just these, and I'll be finished with this. If the reader doesn't believe it, all bets are off. And the response, and he wants to believe that it ends this way because it's the only possible way for it to end. It's that has that feeling of an inevitability.
Body is almost a kind of a companion piece to the book, the Knockout Artist, isn't it? Because here you're dealing with people who are very much involved with physicality.
Yes, well, I can tell you, I have thought a lot about it. And I told you that I've spent much of my life in gymnasiums of one kind or another. I fought as a young man and boxed. I am fascinated with athletics and physical prowess because it is the only place that I can get a kind of truth that I can get nowhere else in the world. I can't get it from my government. I can't get it from institutionalized religion. I can't get it even from my best friends half the time. But let me tell you what I mean by that. If you tell me you got 4.4 speed in a 40, well, we got some watches, bud. We'll go measure 40 yards and see what kind of speed you got. And you either got it or you don't have it. You say you can bench press 500 pounds, we got a prone press bench. We'll load up a bar and we'll see. And you can either do it or you cannot do it. There's a great player, a football player, Neon Dion, also nicknamed Primetime. That sucker's got 4.2 speed in a 40. You hear about it, but you don't often see a guy that's actually got it. He's got it. He's like Muhammad Ali is and was in past times more. He got a lot of mouth talk, shucks and jives. But when it comes time to produce, he's the goods, bud, and he's got it. And I know that that sort of truth, perhaps, put against philosophical truth or truth concerning faith or the lack of it, nobility or the lack of it, compassion or the lack of it, is pretty weak stuff. I realize that. But at least it's the truth. And if worked right, working out of that physical and concrete truth, which is demonstrable, one can get at some of that other truth that is harder to take hold of. It's very slippery. Faith and compassion and mercy and all those other abstract nouns you ever heard of, which after all is as far as I'm concerned, what fiction writers and fiction writing is all about. I'll even make an outrageous, it's not outrageous, but it's a pretty strong thing to say, but I'll say it anyway. Writing fiction is a moral profession practiced by not necessarily moral men and women. Finally, is about good and evil. It's about good and right and wrong. I mean, who's right, who's wrong, and for what reasons. And you're trying to engage the reader to that place where he has to show mercy or compassion, or, yeah, I know you did wrong. He's talking to a guy you made up in a book on the page there, but he's thinking, he may not be saying it out loud, he's thinking, yeah, you did wrong, pal, but I see where you came from. in the same place, what the hell? I may have done the same thing myself. I've been ashamed of it, but I may have done it too. Damn. And so that's why a good book will inevitably turn you back upon yourself to re-examine yourself. I don't think you can read a really fine piece of fiction without being a different human being after it's over than it was before, than you were before. It changes you. It changes in all kinds of ways that are immeasurable and that cannot be demonstrated. But I'm going to go to my grave believing it, because I've been trying to write fiction for 25 years, and I believe it as strongly now as I believed it then when I started. So, I'm screwing up your... I keep turning around.
Let's talk about some of the specifics in body. I'd always... The bodybuilder I'd always pictured as kind of an exhibitionistic show-off, but they have hearts, and they have minds, and they work. Tell me about these people. You must have worked with them yourself to be able to depict them in this way.
Well, I trained a girl. I had them in for Maggie Powell, the girl who took the picture in the back of the book. That book was never been written. It's got her name right beside the picture there. I trained her, if she would have been willing to weigh more than 125 pounds, she possibly could have won the world. She won Miss Southeastern United States. When she asked me to train her, she said, "How far do you think I can go in bodybuilding?" I said, "How much pain can you stand? How long can you stand it?" And here's what I want to say about something about bodybuilding. I know that most people think that bodybuilding is a joke. But I want to hear say that courage is not a joke. That perseverance and tenacity are not jokes. That deprivation and denial towards some goal is not a joke. And last of all, the ancient Greeks believing that self-competition was the highest form of competition is not a joke. And all of those things are at work. When anybody, whether he's a competitive bodybuilder or just works out in a weight gymnasium, all of those things would work when he steps through the front door. I'm the oldest guy in the gym where I work out. I raced and rode motorcycles for years and have no knees to show it. But I take to the gym what I've got to take to the gym. The same as, you know, it's really rather like writing a novel. I just go to it with what I've got. And I do what I can do. And the guys in the gym, the young bucks, you know, that are in the flower of their manhood, young, and they want to be 255 with 52-inch chest and 28-inch waist and all that sort of thing. It's not my place, province, business to approve or disapprove. Just in a great many places, I have no particular axe to grind either way. But... I find nothing in there but acceptance and calm. I've been in the same gym for 13 years, and it's a good place to go. I wake up in the morning at 3 o'clock, and by about 4, I've managed to get started writing. And I work from 4 until 9. And then I go to the gym and work off all that nervous energy and 2 gallons of coffee I've swallowed. And then take a hot shower and shave, and I'm ready to face the rest of the day. It's better than 3 Valium, because man, at least for me, the quality of concentration that it takes to write just fairly well is so intense that after 3 hours, or you know, maybe for me 4 max, but not 3 hours, I feel like I've been beaten by a baseball bat. Now, I know there are very fine writers who say that they work for long periods of time. Every writer that you meet does it a different way. Some guys can never work any time except in the middle of the night. Some never been in the morning. You know, they do it all kinds of ways. There's no way to do it. You just do it. In the same way, there's no way to write a novel, because, after all, we call War and Peace and Catcher in the Rye novels. Well, try reading them back to back. And you see that it's like calling an aardvark a giraffe, or confusing the two. There's no way to write a novel. You just, but there are obviously aspects of the novel, to use an E.M. Forster phrase in the title of his book, that one can abstract out of fiction and talk about. Time, the treatment of time and point of view and all that nonsense nobody cares anything about except writers. But knowing that won't make you a writer, and knowing that won't make you able to write to be a writer. I mean, I don't know what makes you. I really don't. If I did, I'd tell you. I sometimes go to writers' conferences. Used to. I was at Bredlow 6 years when I was very young, and it seemed to me that all the apprentice writers or would-be writers, whatever, they're good people, that they all felt like that we who were publishing books had some sort of secret that if we would but say it, that they then could go home and write a novel. And, of course, we were lost. I mean, you know, all these questions are unanswerable. How do you get started? Where do you get your ideas, as though novels are made from ideas? It doesn't hurt to have one now and then, but made out of people. And
In body, the hilarity of the book was such that I was not prepared for the ending, which was really a bummer. I'm not going to give that away. But why did you decide? I figured that Cherelle would lose, but I didn't figure that she would lose in the way that she did. How is it that you left us kind of
in
the lurch?
You may not want to give it away, but Cherelle loses it in such a way that she has lost her life, and having lost her life literally takes it. And when you have, I don't want to make it too cliché-ish, you know, eggs in a basket and all that, but when you have focused your entire future life, people admiring you or not admiring you, or your selfhood, what the bone deep being of who you are, on this thing, and somehow have it go up in smoke. Sometimes grave consequences result. Human beings being human beings, we only have a certain amount of strength and wherewithal to keep going. Some have more than others. And I've not caught any flack about it in print. I have had people, some of them my friends who know me well, and then some from strangers who were not pleased, but not necessarily surprised. There have been people unkind enough. I shouldn't say unkind. Well, there have been people, critics, reviewers, whatever, who say that I deliberately write the endings on so many of my novels that I do to sensationalize the book or something else. Well, I tell you, bud, to say that to somebody that feels about fiction the way I feel about fiction and what I've given up to write the fiction I've written, to say something like that to somebody such as I am is enough to make me weep. I mean, I don't want to hurt you or hit you or anything like that. I want to almost cry because you have so thoroughly and totally misunderstood me. And a writer does not want to be misunderstood. And to think that of me then diminishes my work and consequently diminishes me. But that's all right. That's the nature of the world. You do your work, you take your chances. There are going to be people that like you, people that don't like you. And
Well, isn't that the nature of an artist? He creates something and then he hands it to an uncaring audience.
Well, you know, yes, and he always hopes that there will be, let's say, a significant number that will care, and then maybe there will be a significant number who won't care.
It's the job of the writer to make them care.
Yeah, try.
The turnip seed family, a hilarious hard scrabble Georgia family.
Just the kind of people I grew up with, but I'm off a tenant farm in South Georgia. That's where I grew up. I learned how to drive a car when I was 21. I never lived in a house that had electricity until I went in the Marine Corps at 17. We plowed with mules. Nobody had a tractor. They didn't have a tractor in South Georgia when I went in the Marine Corps. And those are the people I grew up with. A guy like Nailhead. Nailhead is generous to a fault, reticent among strangers, and will sir you to death. But he feels like that a grown man or woman should realize that there are boundaries over which you should not step. You insult his blood. We're talking about blood kin now. We call them our connections, uncles, aunts, greats, great aunts, grandmas, whatever. You insult the blood, he won't talk to you. He'll kill you. He won't maim you. He'll kill you. And there's certain other parts, Northeast Louisiana, same way. Parts of Mississippi, same way. They're among the kindest people in the world, and I don't have an answer to it. It's not that they're so much thin-skinned. It's just that they feel like that. Now, they sometimes let it slide one or two times. If you say something, they'll figure, well, he just doesn't understand what he's saying. But as soon as they realize, yes, that sucker does know what he's saying, too. He's saying it with malice aforethought, though they would not use that phrase. And then it's time to, you know, get down to blood. You want blood? We'll show you blood. And there have been more people killed in South Georgia over bird dogs and fence lines than anything else. You know, it didn't take much to get guys.
Almost out of time, Harry Prince. Are you still living in Tallahassee?
Tallahassee is Florida State, FSU, Florida State University. I'm at the University of Florida, which is in Gainesville, center of the state.
Gainesville.
Ninth largest university in the country. Yeah. It's a factory. I shouldn't say that. If you're listening in the University of Florida, don't pay any attention to that. No, we're a big school.
Are you still teaching?
Yeah. Yeah, I work with, they pay me to teach. I work with 10 or 12 students, young men and women who think they want to be fiction writers. And they're in graduate school, and they've made some commitment economically, and they're older students, you know. They're not undergraduate students, and they work very hard, and they do some very good work, and Donald Justice, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, got the office right next to mine, and we got some good people there. And to tell you the honest to God's truth, I'd like it. I always liked it, and I like it still. I keep saying, I'd have been saying for the last 10 years I was going to quit, because I don't live with anybody but my dog, Heidi, 13-year-old golden retriever, and she doesn't need much, and I don't need much, you know, there it is. But I don't know. There's something about young people, the kind of young people that we have these days. Perhaps we've always had them, and I didn't notice them. But they keep you honest. Mm-hmm. You start shucking and jiving and telling lies, they'll run you up a tree because they ask hard questions. And I like that, because sometimes I do. They ask a hard question. I realize that I have misrepresented myself. That's to say it nicely. To say it not so nicely, I've just told a lie. I say, wait a minute, you're right. I didn't mean it that way. Let's see if I can say it another way. I like that.
I was reading your article in Fame magazine. I was surprised that you struck up this friendship with Sean Penn, of all people.
About 2 days ago, I was in front of his camera acting and seeing John Henry, railroad version of John Henry. He's shooting a film in Omaha, Nebraska. And I've just written a screenplay for him that if luck is with us, we'll start shooting in January or February. Sean's not going to act anymore. He's going to direct. He simply can't bear the... Now, we're very, very good friends, and I've never seen any of the behavior, except when people force him into it.
Well, he's taken swings at a lot of people. He was in jail for it, I understand.
Well, Bud, if 15 guys with 15 cameras got you in that corner and you can't get out, and they're all swinging those damn cameras, and some of them are hitting you in the head and the rest of it, what are you going to do? Stand there and let them beat you to death?
Why doesn't he just stand still, let them take their pictures? You know, he almost is a...
I was with him, and, of course, he was with Madonna then, too. Madonna and Sean took me to the Tyson Spinks fight, and it was like going to a slaughterhouse. And... And all right, let's say that his job calls for him to stand that, and that he ought to take it with great calmness and let him take his picture. Well, he is not temperamentally suited for that. Mm-hmm. He now realizes it. He told me, he said, Scorsese can walk down the street and go in a store and get a hamburger and nobody says anything to him. I can't even go buy a car. And so he wants to get out of that and not do nothing. His dad is a director, Leo Penn, and a good one. And his mama's a great actress. And he wants to direct and hope that people will finally lose recognition of and leave him alone. I don't know. I'm not defending the guy. The fellow's just been good and decent and upfront, straight talking with me ever since I've known him. And I count him as a friend, and I don't defend him. If the public wants to hate him, that's their business. And if he hasn't done something wrong and in bad taste, he's the only human being I've ever met who hasn't.
So, Harry Cruz, it's wonderful to talk to you. I mean, I could sit here and listen to you for hours. it's wonderful entertainment and terrific insights too on the nature of writing and the nature of fiction and body the book A Tragic Comedy. It's a very good kind of a, is this called a subtitle? Not a subtitle. What's it called? I don't know.
I don't quite know. But whatever it is,
but it's,
Tragic
but
Comedy.
It's true. Yes. It's true.
Well, thank you for your kind remarks. I appreciate that. It's good talking with you.
And thank you very much. Hang on a second. Shut off the tape.